Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role do bees play in America's agricultural wealth, and what happens when farmers want to grow more produce than local insects can pollinate? If your diet this week will include cherries, blueberries, watermelon, lettuce, or especially almonds, chances are an itinerant beekeeper has played a role in producing your meals by placing colonies of bees strategically close to the fields or orchards that grow the food. In fact, while they do derive income from the honey, a lot of commercial apiarists earn more by providing 3 weeks of almond pollination than by harvesting a year's worth of syrup. Journalist Hannah Nordhaus looks into this demanding but vital profession in her new book, The Beekeeper's Lament, How One Man and a Half Billion Honeybees Help Feed America. Hannah, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So one big takeaway from this book is that at the same time that honeybees are incredibly hardy, they're also incredibly fragile. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So honeybees, you know, individually are incredibly fragile little insects. You know, if they don't heal from wounds, they just die. And the way they overcome this fragility individually is because they have these huge booming communities that are the colonies, the beehives. And so it's strength in numbers. But in recent years, it's been really hard for beekeepers, even with large numbers of bees, to keep them alive because there's just so many pests and pathogens that are sweeping through the nation's apiaries, and they just can't recover.
So more and more people are basically getting out of the commercial honeybee business.
Yeah. Probably 20 years ago, there were 5,000 commercial beekeepers, which is defined as people who have more than 300 beehives and make a living keeping bees. And last I checked, which was about 3 or 4 years ago, there were 1,200. And I bet you that number's dropped since then, because every year beekeepers are losing about a third of their hives.
Wow.
And that's just not sustainable for them.
So this really is a story about the beekeepers as much as about the insects. And the central figure in your book is a fourth-generation professional whose work has really a significant impact, as the title suggests, on the food we eat every day.
Yeah, the book's really focused on this one guy named John Miller, who is a fourth-generation beekeeper, as you said. He has been keeping bees his whole life. So did his dad, so did his grandfather, and so did his great-grandfather. And he has 10,000 hives, and he trucks them all over the West and takes them from crop to crop, pollinating flowers. So his big crop is almonds in February, and then he goes to cherries and apples, and then he spends the summer up in North Dakota making honey from clover and alfalfa fields.
He has such a personality that I have to say, I think I would have read the book even if he'd been like a tax accountant. he is a devout but very unconventional Mormon, for one thing.
Yeah, he has a hard time with authority. and he's a really restless soul. So you know, he's quite well suited to the job that he does, to moving all over the country, and perhaps less well suited to traditional family life.
How did you find this guy and this story? Because you know, most people who write books about bees also have some hives, at least in their backyard or something. And this does not describe you.
No, I wasn't that interested in bees before I met John Miller. I have a big sweet tooth. I love candy. And at some point in the last few years decided that honey was healthier than sugar, and I eat a lot of honey now. And when I met John Miller, I was actually writing an article for a natural foods magazine about a company called Honey Stinger, which makes honey-based energy gels, like the kind of things that you'd eat if you're running a marathon or doing a long bike ride.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one of the owners, and I interviewed him for that article, and he talked about his life as a migratory beekeeper, and I had at that point had no idea that there were these guys, and they are mostly guys, who have thousands of beehives and truck them all over the country. And so he was just so funny and engaging. So I think we talked for like an hour and a half, and I just made a note that I wanted to learn more about him. Ended up writing a long article about him and the crisis that his bees were going through, because it was sort of right as all the bees started dying off about 5 years ago. And then I still had more to say, as did he. He has lots to say. So that turned into a book.
Yeah, he's really interesting because he'll go on and on about how he prefers bees to people, but he is pretty generous with his time. You know, it sounds like when people contact him with a problem or a question, he does his best to answer fully, if not maybe more fully than the person with the query might have wanted.
Yeah, I mean, he is definitely a people person, probably more so than a lot of beekeepers. But I've actually found that most of the beekeepers I talked to for this book are just, you know, they love being around people. They love talking. They love telling stories. A lot of them are really good storytellers. Maybe not all of them are quite as funny as John Miller, and he is really funny. But they all also love to get away.
Yeah.
And I would say that John Miller, it's also true. I mean, as I've gotten to know him, he'll just disappear. he gets overloaded, and, you know, I think attention, you know, he can stay focused for a little while, but then he has to go off and do something else. So I feel like he needs his bees to be able to support his personality of being such an engaging and engaged and giving person with all the people around him as well.
So, Hannah, we'll talk in a minute about the day-to-day obligations of John Miller's job, but first of all, explain why there aren't enough bees flying around naturally to do the work that John Miller and his colleagues have to do.
Okay, well, first of all, the honeybee is not native to North America, mm-hmm. But it came over with the first colonists in the 1620s, so it's been here a long time, and it thrived for many, many years without human help. They just, you know, swarms go off and go find a tree to live in, and then they go feral and live for many generations. But in the last 20 years, starting in about 1987, this nasty little parasitic mite called the varroa mite was found for the first time in the U.S. It had come from Europe and before that from Russia and Asia. And that mite pretty much knocked out all the feral hives in the country. There's a few surviving populations, but it really just wreaked havoc on all the feral bees. And beekeepers were able to keep their bees alive with the help of some medicines they gave them. But the mite, it's a wily little creature, and it slowly became resistant. And then in about 2004, 2005, it became resistant to the latest medicine. And so beekeepers have really been struggling in the last few years. So now there aren't many wild bees now to pollinate crops. But in addition, you know, crops are so big these days. There's these huge swaths of monoculture. You know, the almond orchards in the Central Valley of California, which are the big payday for beekeepers now to pollinate, there's about 750,000 acres in this 400-mile stretch of the Central Valley. And they bloom for 3 weeks, and then the petals fall off, and there's nothing for native pollinators or for honeybees in the area to eat. So when you have crops at that vast scale, you really have to bring in, you know, outsource your pollination.
And what's really interesting here is that it used to be that the beekeepers paid farmers of different types to put their bees there so that the bees could collect nectar and create their honey, and now it's the opposite.
Yeah, for the most part. There's some crops that don't require pollination that make really good honey, like oranges, and beekeepers still pay farmers for that. They typically pay in honey, though. there's not a lot of cash exchanged in that direction because beekeepers don't have a lot of cash. But for the other crops, like almonds and cherries, berries, all the vine crops, farmers and beekeepers are helping each other out, but farmers at this point need beekeepers more than beekeepers need those farmers. So the farmers pay the beekeepers usually a modest amount to leave their hives there during the bloom. But in the case of almonds, it's actually quite a significant amount. And for most of these guys, that's how they make their living now. Honey prices are really variable, and often they below the price of production. So it's really pollination that keeps beekeepers afloat.
So is it hard for bees to have like a balanced diet if they're eating only what they can get from, say, almond flowers?
Well, they're starting to do more and more research into honeybee nutrition, and they didn't know much about nutrition, you know, given all that, you know, how long we've been dependent on honeybees and how important they are. There hasn't been a lot of research into nutrition, but in recent years, as the bees have been dying and people have been trying to figure out what's causing these huge die-offs, they have started to look at whether nutrition's a factor. And there's a few things. You know, I think the issue of monocrops, of eating just one flower for a number of weeks, they're wondering if that's bad for bees. And then in addition, beekeepers often, when they ship these huge amounts of bees into a new field, they usually get there before the bloom. So they often have to give them supplemental feed until something's blooming. So a lot of them have been giving them corn syrup or sugar syrup. And John Miller, for instance, used to give his bees corn syrup. And in recent years, he decided that it just doesn't seem like it's good for his bees, and he only gives them sugar syrup. And they also have, you know, the honey that's in their hives that is usually not enough to sustain them. So there's, you know, what's the crops that they're eating and the supplemental feed that they're getting. And bee scientists and beekeepers are beginning to wonder whether that's a factor in why the bees have been weakened so much.
It's funny to think that corn syrup, we now know, is not so good for us, and it's also not so good for bees.
No, it appears not to be.
Okay, so let's talk about this. Why is it that honeybees produce more honey by far than they need to sustain the hive in an average year?
Because that's what they do. they make honey. They don't sort of let up when they decide they've made too much honey. What they would typically do if they made a lot, had a lot more supplies and were more productive than the hive needed. Part of the hive would then go off, swarm off, and you know, they'd make a new queen, and they'd go off and start a new colony, and then that had, you know, build up new beeswax supplies, new cells, and fill that with more honey. And in the beekeeping world, instead, beekeepers stop them from swarming by adding new boxes where they can put more honey and that sort of thing. So. But basically, you know, it's you know, there are bad years and there are good years, and like anybody, you always want to stockpile for the bad years, and so that's what honeybees do. They just keep producing until they run out of room.
What's the price of honey like these days for people who want to sell it to make a living?
You know, I don't actually know what it is this year. It's fluctuated up and around a dollar. Sometimes it goes up to two. Sometimes it goes down to below a dollar. For John Miller, I know if it drops below a dollar, he's losing money on it.
Dollar pound.
Yeah, dollar pound.
And there's honey from other countries that may not be purely honey. It's watered down in some cases?
Yeah. Particularly, they've had a problem particularly with honey from China. The Chinese have gotten into the beekeeping industry, and Like a lot of Chinese competitors, they've sort of, their business practices are not always as good as they could be. They sometimes adulterate it, and they've dumped it on the U.S. market at prices that U.S. beekeepers just simply can't match. And some of that has water in it, some of it has corn syrup in it, and they've often treated their bees with antibiotics and stuff that aren't approved for sale, you know, that U.S. beekeepers can't use, but they're cheap and it's easy to do it in large numbers. So you don't really know what you're getting with imported honey. There's no standard of identity that the FDA has pushed for other foodstuffs. You can't say this is honey. Honey should be like this. It should have this amount of water and this amount of sucrose and that sort of thing. The Chinese honey, you just don't know what you're getting, and it's really undercut the prices for U.S. honey as well.
My guest this hour is journalist Hannah Nordhaus. Her new book is called The Beekeeper's Lament, How One Man and a Half Billion Honeybees Help Feed America. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Hannah Nordhaus. Her new book is called The Beekeeper's Lament, How One Man and Half a Billion Honeybees Help Feed America. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Hannah, did John Miller ever consider any line of work outside the family business?
Well, I guess he dropped out of college in, when he was like 19 or 20, and went to work for at an Albertsons supermarket for a little while, and that was about his only foray into the world of non-beekeeping. I think he quickly realized that he needed to be among bees, but it was handed down from his father, and after this brief moment of rebellion, it's sort of what he's always done, and he really is quite passionate about keeping bees and being a better beekeeper.
But he's got grown kids, and they have not taken up the mantle.
Well, actually, this is new since the book came out, but his son Jason has just decided to go into the family business. He was working for Apple Computers out in Silicon Valley, and now he's going to become the fifth generation of the Miller family to be a beekeeper.
Wow. So did Jason, did he go along with his dad as a kid on some of these trips?
When they were young, Miller took his family with him to North Dakota every summer, and then they'd go down to California for the fall and winter and spring. And so he grew up among bees and apparently is quite a talented beekeeper. But John, liked to think that his kids had more sense than to go into beekeeping. And apparently that's not the case.
Talk about this little town in North Dakota where he sort of sets up shop in the summertime. And I guess processing honey is a pretty laborious thing to do.
It is, yeah. So he spends the summers in Gackle, North Dakota, which is sort of south central North Dakota. And it's this wonderful little farm town. I had never been to North Dakota before I visited, and I was just so taken with the town. It's just so beautiful and quaint. And, as the rest of the country sort of sprawls into shopping malls, these North Dakota farm towns have sort of been preserved, and they just keep getting smaller and smaller. And so, it's a place where everybody knows your name, and you never have to use your blinkers because everybody knows exactly where you're going. And so he keeps a honey house there and keeps all his bees spread out over many miles of territory of fields in the summertime. And his honey house is where he brings all the supers, which are the boxes that they put on top of the beehive that keep just honey in them. And he brings them in and processes them. And it's hot and it's honey smelling. And he has all these various contraptions and machines that process the honey, and it's a lot of work.
And we should say he's not a one-man band. I mean, he has employees that work with him.
Yeah, he has some regular employees who, he has one guy who travels with him all over, who sort of manages the business with him, and then different employees in each location, and then he imports employees from South Africa every summer to help with the bee harvest and the honey processing.
And I love the descriptions. People who really know honey can take a tiny little spoonful and tell you, oh, that came from peaches and that came from onions, which I take it is not a good kind of honey.
Apparently not. I've never tasted it. I've been fortunate to only taste the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the weird stuff. But each flower produces a different type of nectar, and that produces a different kind of honey. And they really... honey is honey, but when you taste them side by side, you can really tell the different flavors, and some of them are just fantastic.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phones now, and we'll speak with Doug in Dallas. Hello, Doug.
Hello, Chris. Hello, Ms. Nordhaus.
Hi, Doug.
I don't know, when you talk about transporting the bees up and down the coast, I get this vision like the old chicken coops piled up 17 tall on this old pickup or whatever, but what do they use to transport the hives, and how do they keep the bees from flying away? I'll take my answer off the phone.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a good question. So he uses semis, and I guess he uses two kinds, but the kind he prefers is a drop deck because he could fit more on there. I think he can stack them four high, and I think he can fit 512 hives per semi, and he covers them with netting so that they don't fly away. And they tend to drive at night because bees are less active at night, or not active at all at night. And so they're if you take off at night, you're not going to have bees out foraging. You'll have more of them in the hive. And they, you know, if you stop at a gas station, they're not going to try to go off and attack people.
But his brother a few years ago got into a pretty serious accident.
Yeah. Yeah, he flipped a semi in Montana and just, you know, smeared bees and honey all over the road. And fortunately, he was able he had injured his arm, but he was able to get out before the bees quite realized what had happened, because I think he got 20 stings. But if he hadn't gotten out, if he had, it had taken him longer to get out, he could have been, you know, stung hundreds of times. And when those trucks crash, it is a real mess, because there's just honey and globs of bees, and, you know, you have to get guys out in beekeeping suits. It's not just the regular people who clean up traffic accidents. You need specialists. So, it's, of course, a disaster for the beekeeper, because they've just lost a lot of income.
And I can imagine your average big brawny state trooper who has no problem going into a lot of situations might shy away from stepping in to help out in these situations.
Yeah. And actually, John Miller tells us this story about this guy who used to transport drugs in his beehives because he figured that no troopers were going to inspect his bees. And I think he got away with it for quite a long time. So, you know, it's your average state trooper is not really all that comfortable with bee trucks.
You learned a thing or two about what not to do when you've been stung once or twice. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I had never been stung by a bee before I wrote this book, and I sort of thought, because they're such, you know, they're not as aggressive as yellow jackets and hornets, that it wouldn't hurt as much as yellow jackets and hornets, but in fact, it hurts more, I think. Mm-hmm. And so the first time I got stung in the eye, and it was just one bee, it wasn't, I mean, it hurt a lot, but it wasn't in terms of, you know, it was over when I got stung. But the second time, I got some bees in my hair, and I just, you know, lost it. I threw down, I had my reporter's notebook and my pen and my digital voice recorder, and I threw everything on the ground and started running around in circles and flapping my arms. And finally, one of John Miller's employees grabbed me and took me inside, which is the smart thing to do if bees are bothering you, is to go inside where there aren't any bees. And she got the bees out of my hair and pulled the stinger out, and all is well. But, you know, you shouldn't run in circles and flap around. You should run away from the bees. And best thing you can do is get inside.
And don't jump in the water.
Don't jump in the water, because then they just wait for you to come up. And then they sting your mouth and nose. And then it makes it even harder to breathe.
You know, it's funny, Hannah, I didn't enjoy reading about you getting bees in your hair. But I thought about that old expression about somebody having a bee in her bonnet. And suddenly it made more sense to me than it ever had before.
Yeah, it's amazing. I've you know, I'm still realizing how many of these bee expressions are, you know, come from beekeeping, and you don't even, like, you talk about droning on, and drones are the male honeybees, and they make noises, and there's all these bee in your bonnet, all the bee line, all these expressions that come from beekeeping that you just don't even think about.
My guest is Hannah Nordhaus. Our number, 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Murphy and speak with Andre. Hi, Andre.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask, I think you were talking about the almond fields, that the flowers only bloom for like 3 weeks. What would it take to keep a beehive going and to keep it in one place? How much bloom time would you need?
Like if you wanted to have one in your garden or something?
Sure.
What do you know about that, Hannah?
Well, you sort of need things blooming all year round. And obviously they can stockpile, and then they'll have honey to eat between blooms. But, I mean, not all year round. I guess maybe down in Texas that might be the case. Up in northern climates, things don't bloom, obviously, in the winter. And that's why they stockpile all that honey to tide them over for the winter. But, you know, one of the things that people talk about in trying to make landscapes more bee-friendly is to have, you know, hedgerows and crop borders where there are wildflowers that bloom different times of year. And but 3 weeks a year is certainly not sufficient to feed a hive.
So let's talk about colony collapse disorder, which we've alluded to several times, that, you know, a third of the bees every year sort of disappear, and they literally disappear. It's not that they all are found in their hive dead. They just go away somewhere.
Yeah, so the first time anybody noticed this condition was in late 2006, when this guy, Dave Hackenberg, who is a like John Miller, a migratory beekeeper. He doesn't have as many hives as John Miller, but he's very well regarded in the industry. And he takes his bees between Florida and Pennsylvania. And he was visited some hives that were in a bee yard in Florida and noticed that the hives, all the adult bees had flown off. All the foragers were gone, but there was still a queen there and still stocked with honey, and they looked perfectly healthy. And then this happened to tons of his hives, and he started calling around and finding out that it was happening to other beekeepers as well. And by the spring of 2007, it was sort of a full-blown epidemic, and it was named colony collapse disorder. And it got a lot of press because it was so weird and mysterious, and nobody could understand what was happening. And so it's killed, I think that year in 2007, it killed about 36% of the nation's colonies. And in subsequent years, about 30 to 36% of the bees, of the country's bees have died off, but it hasn't necessarily been due to colony collapse disorder, but it is still a factor. I think this last year, the numbers just came out, and about 30% of the nation's bees died, and they think 30% of those losses were due to colony collapse disorder.
And there are a variety of theories. None of them seems to be entirely sufficient on its own to explain what's going on. But one thing that you write about here that appears not to be the case is that cell phone signals are causing this.
Yeah. So that was one source of early speculation, was that the bees were being disoriented by cell phone signals. And that's never really held water among beekeepers, certainly, because a lot of their bees are in these remote places where they don't even get cell phone signals. But it keeps coming up. And just recently, there was a study that said that bees were disturbed by cell phones in their hive. And there was a big flurry of media about it. But when I went and read the study a little closer, and the guy actually put cell phones inside the hives and had them ring, and then what he proved was that they were disturbed for 12 hours afterwards. And I mean, I would be disturbed if a cell phone was ringing in my bed in the middle of the night too. So I didn't find that persuasive at all, and I don't get the sense that many of the bee scientists in the country feel that way either.
Yeah, and it doesn't appear that people are accidentally leaving their phones inside the hives.
No, and it's really hard, you know, like, it's hard to talk on your phone when you're surrounded by buzzing bees. So, I don't think, like, whenever I went and worked bees with John Miller, I just left my phone in the truck. So, it's not like there was a phone right there anyhow.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Ferris and speak with Herschel. Hey, Herschel.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great, thanks.
I've enjoyed the conversation. I'm driving right now, but I live I live between Red Oak and Ferris, about 20 miles south of Dallas, and we have some acreage. Our next door, across the street from us, across the road, county road, is he has some beehives. In fact, my son raised bees for a period of time. But we have, from our water meter down to where our house is almost 1,000, well, about 500 feet, and we have a cutoff valve in the middle of the field, so we don't have to go all the way up to the water meter, you know, to shut off if we have a water problem or something.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this box set down in the ground where the cutoff valve is. So what do you think happens in that box in the cutoff where the cutoff valve is?
Oh, no, you have a de facto colony of bees.
Well, it's happened more than once, as a matter of fact, and I really feel terrible about it because we've had situations where we've had to cut our water off for various reasons. And we go off to that box in the field, and seriously, it is packed with honeycombs and with bees and whatever the deal is.
Do you go down there with a smoker or something?
No, not with a smoker. we just move real fast.
Yeah, I guess when it's an emergency, you can't wait and call the beekeeper.
Right, no, you can't. I mean, it's one of those deals where you don't call people to come and get the bees out. But, I mean, I've had to basically obliterate those, you know, the beehive that's in our cutoff box in order to shut the valve off, you know.
Hmm.
And I'm not asking for a solution to that problem, but I mean, I'm just, anecdotal type of whatever. So there are some feral bees that are still out there.
Yeah, they might be swarms escaped from your neighbor, which is what often happens.
That could have happened.
Yeah.
And they do come down. Yeah, we have a lot of honey, flowers, wildflowers in the springtime, and a number of other things on the property.
Yeah, it sounds like bee paradise, Hannah.
Yeah, and, you know, there are feral bees, obviously, but these sort of survivor stock, these long-term generations of feral bees, and there are some still, I hear, but typically if you find, you know, a swarm's taken over your water cutoff valve box, it's probably bees that escaped pretty recently.
Hmm.
And, you know, they haven't been living in the wild for that long. But, you know, maybe if you kept some hives nearby, they'd stay there instead.
So, yeah, better accommodations outside the water cutoff box.
Perhaps.
Did you hear a lot of those stories along the way? I mean, you were dealing with commercial beekeepers and people who are well in control of this, but do they lose bees a lot to, you know, I don't know, condos that they sort of built on their own?
They do. And, it used to be one of the greatest enemies of beekeepers was swarming, because before the modern beehive where you could check your bees all the time, mm-hmm. you just had no idea what was happening inside the hive and when they were prepared to swarm. And there were, you know, some very subtle signals, but this is back in like the 19th century. But, you know, once your bees swarmed and you lost them, then you know, you went off and tried to find them and coax them back into the hive. But and even today, you know, it's a point of pride for beekeepers that they know their hives and, you know, stave off a swarm before it happens, because then you've lost your honey production center for the summer. But especially with these big outfits like John Miller, there's no way he can visit every hive and know exactly what's going on. So he loses bees all the time.
My guest this hour is journalist Hannah Nordhaus. Her new book is called The Beekeeper's Lament, How One Man and Half a Billion Honeybees Help Feed America. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. Take more of your calls to 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Hannah Nordhaus. Her new book is called The Beekeeper's Lament, How One Man and Half a Billion Honeybees Help Feed America. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Hannah, you were talking about professional beekeepers and I guess hobbyist beekeepers as well, having the skills to stave off a swarm when it's about to happen. I mean, is that like about a bunch of promises, or do you make the space a little bigger? What do you do to keep them in the original hive if they seem to want to go elsewhere?
Well, a lot of times they need space.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can add a super, so, you know, which is one of the honey boxes on top,
uh-huh.
so that they have more places to put honey and pollen. And that's the main thing. And, you know, hives, colonies swarm for different reasons. Sometimes they swarm.
Are you there? Okay, we are having trouble with our connection to Hannah Nordhaus. We will get her back on the line here momentarily. My guest, as I mentioned, is journalist Hannah Nordhaus. Her new book is called The Beekeeper's Lament, How One Man and Half a Billion Honeybees Help Feed America. Okay, you're back with us, Hannah?
I'm here.
Okay, great. I'm sorry. You were saying that they swarm for different reasons, sometimes because they need space and...
Sometimes because their queen is failing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So you know, if things aren't going well... And they, because their queen's failing, there's nothing to eat.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different scenario, and in that case, you might need to divide the hive and make things better. Maybe give them supplemental feed or something like that. But if things are going too well, then if you give them more space, then you can often stave off a swarm.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Winston on the line, headed from Houston to Dallas by car. Hope you're driving safely. Winston, hi.
Yes, I am. Hi, my name is Winston Lee Mascarena. So my question is this. I'm a encaustic artist, which means I incorporate beeswax with various different hanging mediums to produce my works. And with the diminishing beehives that you're talking about, how is that affecting the supply of beeswax for various commercial uses as well as the artistic field?
I have not heard of a beeswax shortage. In fact, you know, a lot of guys are getting out of the business and melting down their beeswax and selling it, so you might find it for cheap. But, you know, so far, even though the bees are dying and it's very hard on beekeepers, so far the actual numbers of beehives in the country haven't dropped that much because these guys just end up spending more money to restock. So John Miller, my beekeeper, has 10,000 hives, and after a bad year, if he loses 30% of his colonies, he's down to 6,000 or 7,000. But by dividing his hives and buying new queens and restocking, he'll get back up to 10,000 by the end of the year. But he's had to spend more money than he wants to do it.
Where do you buy the queens?
There's a bunch of queen breeders, you know, all over the country. I'm sure there's a ton in Texas. There tend to be local queen breeders, and they're typically in warm places because so that they can get the queens ready before the season starts. And a lot of times they'll sell them to colder places where they need to get up to speed quicker. But there's a huge concentration of queen breeders in Northern California, in near Chico. And John Miller gets all his queens from two breeders there, and a lot of people from all over the country get their queens from that particular area.
Do they just hit the ground running when they've been moved from one area to the next and they're in a totally different environment? Do they know? Does it take them a week or so to sort of acclimate? How does that work?
No. It happens pretty quickly. If there's something blooming, they'll send out scouts and they you know suss out the nectar and pollen supplies and come back and they do this little waggle dance to report where all the supplies are to all the foragers, and then they're off and running. It just has to be warm enough and not raining and have some nectar flow.
I really like reading descriptions about the dances that bees do and the ways that they communicate. Through your research for this book, were you able to sort of spot what might look to the rest of us just like bees moving around doing their thing?
Yes, with guidance.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I could still do it on my own, but it is pretty amazing how they communicate. So if you know a scout goes out and finds a nectar flow, she comes back and does this particular dance. And there are other dances to communicate other things. One of the things that John Miller showed me, we went and captured a swarm, and we brought an empty hive with that had honeycomb and honey in it, and the bees they really want shelter. They don't want to be out in the, especially not with their queen. They don't want to be out exposed.
Mm-hmm.
So if you provide them with an empty hive box, they will go into it pretty quickly. And he showed me how a couple of bees noticed that this box was there and went and checked it out and then came out, and they sort of did this thing fanning their wings and sending out these little pheromones so that everybody else could smell what they were communicating. And they did this particular motion, and then suddenly all the bees just started crawling over each other into the hive box. And it was like this mass movement of bees, and it's pretty amazing to watch.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Alan in Dallas. Hey, Alan.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hannah, my name is Alan Baker, and we shared a birthing class in Boulder 4 years ago.
And you're going to have twins soon, I hear.
Yes, we are. my question is do you raise bees yourself now? And if so, how do you involve your daughter in that, or how have you exposed your daughter to raising bees?
You know, I don't, because of my daughter and now my son. When I signed the contract for the book, I had I think Delia, our daughter, was she was 18 months, maybe almost two, and I thought about doing it then. And then about 3 days after I signed the contract, I found out I was pregnant with another one, and we decided to renovate our house. So it would have been the perfect time then to start keeping bees, but I was both nervous about having a toddler and about our builders, who probably would have killed me if we had introduced bees to the mix. So I didn't do it, but I also asked around at the time, and I sort of got the sense that you know, you can do it with toddlers. Lots of people do, but I've heard all the, you know, people told me these horrible stories about their kids getting stung, and they get more sensitized to, you know, if you have your bee suit, you need to keep it well away from your kids, because kids of beekeepers often develop bee allergies because they get sensitized to the venom on the bee suits. So I just decided that I had enough going on in my life without trying to introduce bees into a very fraught situation. So,
enough living things on your...
Yeah, and I don't think, you know, now I have another 18-month-old, and I don't think I'm going to do it for a while. I'd like to someday. I love honey, and I feel like I should, for a variety of reasons, keep bees someday, but I think I'm going to wait till my kids are older.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will speak with Terry in Plano. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Thanks for letting me speak to you. I love bees, despite having been stung many times. I still love them. And I had a question or comment, I think. I had a swarm one time last summer in a pear tree, and I called a beekeeper to come out, and I asked him what he was going to do with the bees. I thought that I was going to provide bees to some honey producer somewhere, and he told me that he just destroys the bees because no one will take them.
Hmm.
And I was wondering if that is true, or that's the norm, or what. I was really, really surprised.
Yeah, what a
shame.
Well,
you know, down in Texas, you guys have a problem with Africanized bees, and I think a lot of people. I mean, typically, especially in other climates, if you find a swarm, there's always a local beekeeper who will be thrilled to take the bees. But I do know in places like Arizona and Texas where Africanized bees are a problem, and these are the quote-unquote killer bees of that have made their way up from South America and are much more aggressive. They you can't tell them apart from European honeybees, that the typical honeybees that people keep, but they're more aggressive and unpredictable. And so I do think that in those climates there are people, you may be able to find some beekeepers who will take them, but people are more likely to destroy them because they feel that they're more dangerous.
Why do we call them Africanized bees if they originated in, what is it, Brazil?
Yeah, in Brazil. Because there was this Brazilian biologist named Warwick Kerr, and I may not be pronouncing it right, but he brought a bunch of honeybees from Africa that he wanted to breed with European honeybees and to create a breed that would be better adapted to tropical climates.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very well adapted to tropical climates, but they also tended to abscond more, which they'd leave the hive and swarm, and were a lot more aggressive than the bees that European beekeepers had been raising. And so they slowly swarmed north, and I think they crossed into Texas in 1990, and they don't do well in cold climates, so they're mostly in the southern tier states. I think they just spread into Georgia, and Georgia just had its first death from Africanized bee stings. So they are called Africanized because it's an African hybrid.
Mm-hmm. So it was good intentions paving the road to all kinds of problems.
Lots of bee stings. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as always.
Yeah. All right, let's go on the phones this time to Andy in Dallas. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I had actually read something not that long ago about the possibility of humans no longer being able to survive once the bee population expires. I mean, and obviously that's, you know, they pollinate our food and that's where our food source comes from, so it's legitimate. But I was wondering, you know, in the article it said something along the lines of 7 years. If the bee population were to expire, that human beings would only have 7 years to survive. Is that correct?
No, it's not correct. It's actually, it's a pretty funny, that's a quote attributed to Albert Einstein, in which he said that if bees were to disappear from the earth, humans would only have 4 years to survive. And it's, you see it all over the place. And, you know, I did a little research into it because it seemed like an interesting quote. And there's no record that he ever said it, and I think it originated with a bunch of French beekeepers in the early 1990s who were demonstrating against honey tariffs or something like that. And I guess, you know, they put it, the words in the mouth of Albert Einstein, because he was the smartest guy ever, and it seemed like people would listen. But, you know, if bees disappeared, it would be bad. Bees pollinate one-third of our crops, all and a lot of the really good stuff, all the berries, vine crops, obviously almonds. But there's lots of crops that don't need bees, like corn and soy. So our diet would be a lot duller, but I don't think that we would perish from the earth.
So a lot of people who are concerned with environmental protection limit their consumption of animal products, meat certainly, and things from the dairy. Should we limit the amount of honey we eat, or is it okay to eat as much as we can find?
No, eat more honey.
Really?
No, but, you know, the best thing you could do is eat local honey for a variety of reasons. People think that it also helps with allergies, but yeah. You're supporting local, small-scale beekeepers. And you're not hurting honey. You know, bees and humans have this made arrangements over the many millennia, and they take care of each other. And, you know, people take care of bees, and in return, they harvest some honey, and hopefully they don't harvest all the honey. And one thing that beekeepers have learned in recent years is to leave enough honey to sustain the bees over the winter and not supplement it with corn syrup. Mm-hmm. So these guys, they love their bees. They take great care of them. And it's hard, you know, if you buy local honey, then you're supporting beekeepers who are in turn supporting bees. And without them, there would be very few bees left in this country.
Is it possible to guarantee that the honey we eat doesn't have any pesticides in it?
It's pretty hard.
Mm-hmm. Just because they go all over.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who sell organic honey, but there's no way to guarantee it's organic unless it's been produced on, you know, an island where there's zero pesticides used within, you know, anywhere nearby. Someone described bees as flying dust mops. They really are reflections of their environment. And so, you know, you can place your hives on organic crops, but you can't guarantee that they're not going over the farmer 2 miles down the road and who is using pesticides.
Do you did you discover things other than recipes, other uses for honey? Like, do you use it on a burn, or, you know, you hear remedies and things like that?
Yeah, well, it's supposed to have, I think, antibiotic and antimicrobial qualities, so people do use it on wounds, and I hear it works. I think I've done it before, and it didn't. I mean, it wasn't a very bad wound.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then people do use it if they have allergies. If you can find honey harvested from local plants, some people say that that helps desensitize you to those pollens.
Certainly can't hurt, and it's worth a try.
Yeah, and it sure tastes good.
My guest this hour has been journalist Hannah Nordhaus. Her new book is called The Beekeeper's Lament, How One Man and Half a Billion Honeybees Help Feed America. Hannah, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. It was great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.